approved and honored by the invitation. I'm very happy to be with you here and to have the opportunity to present a current research project I'm conducting. This research project started in 2014, so 3 years ago, and it will end this year in summer. We're going to have a conference in November with a kind of summary of the project results and inviting experts from all over the world to be there and speak there. You could read the title of the project on the program, Cultural Transfer of Music in Vienna, 1755 to 1780. This is a project about what is called Wiener Klassik, Wiener's Classic. But it's not in the title and it's not a main topic, but the main question of the project is how Vienna turned from a receiving city, and Austria is a receiving country, to a producing and exporting country and city. So Vienna was as you all know, of course, Vienna was a center of important music at the end of the 18th century. But before, most of the music was brought from outside to there. So there was a lot of migration. There were lots of Italian musicians, singers in the city. There were also a lot of Bohemian musicians there and people from other countries as well. The project focuses on the networks that were working together and that were making possible this increase of production, this very sudden increase of production and of distribution very widely. The methodological point of departure was the concept of cultural transfer. This is a concept that was developed about 25 or 30 years ago, primarily or first for the relationship between France and Germany. And it was intended to replace an older concept, the concept of influence. Influence is a concept where there is a logical relationship between two fields or two countries or two cities or two persons. And there is something flowing from one layer to the other. All the transformations that can be found in the concept in influence are understood as a deterioration or as a loss of authenticity. And it's also the concept of influence is also considered a one-way movement from one side to the other. Instead of this, the concept of cultural transfer does not see two hierarchical relation between, but equal relation between two fields or two locations. And all the transformations that are taking place are considered a new interpretation, are considered something that is worth being studied. So all that is transformed in a piece when it comes from Vienna, for example, to Paris, is interesting for us because we want to know what people in Paris, what they did with this work, how they understood it, even if they understood it differently from people in Vienna. And it's also, cultural transfer is a concept where you have two partners and there is an exchange between the two. It's not a one-way movement. We have we have five fields of topics. If you consider cultural transfer in Vienna in the second half of the 18th century, of course, you could study a lot of music. You would first probably think of Italian opera, which was very prominent here. But I wanted to focus on the developments that were new and developments that involved the middle class. So I excluded in my setting of the project all the relationships of aristocracy. So there is not a topic on Italian opera. It is not about the relationship between the castles or the Bohemian countries or Hungary and the residents. All this kind of aristocratic relationship was kind of excluded, and we focused on new developments, including second, the middle class. In English, it's quite easy. You can say middle class. In German, you have different words for that. In all the literature, you find bürgerliche Musikkultur, bourgeois music culture. But of course, it's not just bourgeois. It's also a higher. It's also including a lower aristocracy. There was quite a big difference between the high nobility and the low nobility. These were people. We can also call in German zweite Gesellschaft, the erste Gesellschaft und die zweite Gesellschaft. So the first society. I don't know if you have similar expressions in Hungary. So this is mostly on the second society, consisting of academics, officials, probably being noble men, but like Baron or Freiherr, so lower nobility, and also capitalists, people that are rich enough to own a piano or to let their children play the piano. So in English, I just say middle class, but in fact it's high middle class. This is also what you can call in German Großbürgertum. This is a term you use for the 19th century. This is the society that built the buildings on the Ringstrasse, for example. So, the first topic was, let me read it in German first and then translate it. Von der Hofkapelle zum Kärntner-Tor-Theater, eine sozialhistorische Topographie des Oratoriums. It's about oratorio. And it's a social historical topography of the oratorio, coming from the court chapel to the theater, to the Kärntner Theater, and thus being transferred from a solely religious context to an aesthetic context, to a concert situation. You know that the oratorio was a very important genre in the early concert, and also in the 19th century. And this is the point where it changed. So we didn't have a good history of the oratorio in Vienna in this time. There are several stages in the development. The first stage is the oratorio at the court. There were regular performances at the court in Lenten time before Easter. But this regular series of performances stopped when Charles VI died in 1740. It was interrupted. We don't have any idea how they thought about it, if they discussed to dismiss it, or if it was just forgot, we don't know. But there was a break in the performance series in 1740, and they started again in 1755. Now the oratorio is being performed in concerts in the theater already, This was the time when Durazzo was the leader of the opera, and Gluck was conducting most of the performances. And in this time, in Lenten time, they had many concerts, and in these concerts they started to integrate also oratorios. In 1755, this was a kind of impulse, new impulse. They had two works by Wagenseil, newly composed, and they took one oratorio by O'Malley, which was very famous, and another one by, well, I'm not sure, I think it was Hasse. Okay, the second stage lasted until 1763, when Durazzo left Vienna, and then there was another break. And the third stage of performance of oratorios was in the concerts of the Tonkünstler Societät, which was a kind of insurance for musicians. You know, formerly, all the people that worked for the court were paid until they died, and even their wives and the children were paid after their death. And this was a big load for the court, and they wanted to get rid of that. So Joseph II initiated this insurance for the musicians. They had to pay for that to be a member of this Tonkünstler Societät. And there were also regular concerts to raise money for the insurance. And in these concerts, oratorios played a big role. They're very important. Until 1778, only Italian oratorios were performing in Vienna. After that, also German oratorios came into play from time to time. One of the first, yes, even Handel's Alexander's Feast, was performed in Italian in Austria around 1770. This is the first of the topics. It's very interesting. We didn't expect that they didn't change the texts. Most of the oratorios that were performed were with the libretto by Metastasio, so quite old, written in the 1730s, and they used it unchanged. They didn't change the word on the text. But as you know, they always wrote new music for the same text. So it's quite similar to the operas, but it's very amazing that they didn't change anything to the text. However, the oratorio was used as a kind of opera. When they didn't play operas, there was a time in the 50s where they played a lot of French opera in Vienna, and they didn't play any Italian opera. And playing Italian oratorios was a chance to get the best singers here, like Gabrieli, a very famous singer who stayed in Vienna for a couple of years. And they also behaved like it was opera, so it was performed in the opera, and they used to play cards beside, or they used chatting. So it was nothing but it was not at all a religious performance in that way. But still, there was another tradition of religious performances of oratorios, which took place in several churches. There are many oratorios performed and composed for Johannes Nepomuk. I don't know the English term. You understand, hopefully. Yeah. This was a very famous saint, and the Habsburgs promoted the rites and this saint especially. And there were also performances of oratorios for Johannes Nepomuk, in churches where Haydn, for example, played the organ. This was another tradition. All in all, we have 26 oratorios that were performed in Vienna, and Marco Motnik was the scholar who worked on this topic. He found out that all the works that came from outside, which was about 20% or so, were imported directly from Venice or from Rome. These were the two main centers of import of oratorios, and another center for oratorios was Munich, interestingly, and they got even the singers from Munich. And there was a little export of this kind of music also, so in some monasteries around Vienna they played the same oratorios, getting the scores from Vienna. I think that's what it's done. The second topic was on, or is on, the monasteries as consumers on the Viennese music market. It's very interesting if you look at the music that monasteries acquired in this time. It was never before and never after that such a new and actual music. And they did starting in the 1760s and 70s. They were very eager to get the newest music from outside. You probably know that some of the earliest Haydn sources are the earliest datable Haydn sources are in Tunisia, for example. Many of the big monasteries had their houses and had some people in the residence, so it was easy for them to acquire music and to bring it to their home. Maybe sometimes they just lent it and gave it back to the copyist, where they achieved it and copied at home at the monastery. Christiane Hornbachner was the scholar, he is the scholar who does her dissertation on this topic, and she found out that the monasteries that had the closest relation to Vienna were Benedictine monasteries in Lower Austria and Upper Austria. Goetheic, Meck, Kelsminster are the most important of these in this exchange. They have the most materials. But she also looked at other monasteries in Lower Austria and in all Austria. There is in Tyrol is Stams, and they have a quite important collection of Viennese music also, and even in Moravia, in Reigern or Reichrad, they have a collection of Viennese music. But it wasn't, still a regional distribution of music. And they mostly acquired instrumental music from Vienna, the latest instrumental music. The monks developments also in science. You know, Kampfmünster had established a new museum for sciences, Stern, which was a tower, which was the first skyscraper in Europe, they say. And this was in competence with Vienna and with the scientific collections they developed, and they presented in Vienna at almost the same time. And they were interested in all kinds of theology and philosophy and in Enlightenment ideas as well. And so they used to travel, and they got a lot of news from outside. And these are the channels also for the music. There is a third topic in the project that is connected to this one. It's called Viennese Instrument Music on the Paris Printing Market. So while the one topic is in a regional focus, the other one is the international focus. Paris was a very important city for distribution of music, as there was a big printing industry, you can say. There were lots of publishers and printers. A little bit later on, there was also printing in England and in Amsterdam, as you know, but Paris was still the main, the most important city for that. Sarah Schulmeister is the scholar, the student, the PhD student who does her dissertation on this topic. And she found out there were lots of composers at the market. The first of them was Georg Christoph Wagenstein, which was printed for the first time in 1755. So 1755, this is the start of the project, and this was a very important time. It's also the start of the new oratorio performances in the theater. It's the start of Austrian or Viennese composers in Paris. Before Maria Theresia started her reign in 1740, but before there was not much time to reform or to be interested in music, so there was a kind of of break in cultural activities. And in 1755, they studied Newman. This was a very important impulse for the whole country. The composers Wagenstein, Hoffmann, Josef Haydn, of course, Aspermeyer, Stephan, the organist and piano master, Gassmann, Barnhall. Beside Haydn, Barnhall probably was the most, in quantity, was the most prolific composer there. And Sarah does some statistics showing that, of course, Haydn was first not very important, and in the late 60s and in the 70s, went up suddenly, and soon he was much more important than any other Viennese composer. We have to see this import of Viennese music also in connection with the import of other German music. In Paris, they didn't differentiate much between Vienna or Mannheim or perhaps Munich. So Mannheim and Vienna were two centers of German music for them, and it was quite mixed up. However, there was one person that was especially interested in music from Vienna, and this was Antoine Huberti, a publisher that specialized on Viennese music. Only one composer is excluded in the sortiment of Huberti. This was Josef Haydn. So, in a way, he didn't have the right nose to choose Haydn. He chose all the others that were going the last attractivity sooner or later. And Huberti it's quite sure that he came to Vienna to get the music. In the, we have not sources, but we have indices that he came in the early 60s to Vienna to acquire new music. And in the late 70s, he went to Vienna, he moved to Vienna to start his own business there. There was no print in Vienna, there was almost no print in Vienna, not very much. And there was Ataria, but they did only art. Hubert, he came there, but he wasn't successful. And he, for a while, he worked for Ataria and then died very poor. So he's an important agent of transfer. And other agents are the Count Kaunitz, which was the prime minister. Very early, he asked Banzai to send some music for Paris. Kaunitz was the ambassador of Austria in Paris in the early 50s, before he became prime minister. And there is a letter from Banzai to Kaunitz. And Banzai was very critical about sending his music somewhere else, because he was not sure if they could play it well. And in this letter, he says, Your Excellence should please tell to them who play my compositions that they have to play it fast. Because they have to play it fast and legato. This will make difficult what seems easy. So he was scared that his music was not performed properly when it's going away. You know, this is a new situation for musicians. Musicians normally composed for a context for musicians they already knew, and they were able to influence them and to tell them how to play. And now they composed music and it was played somewhere else, and there were totally different traditions, and they didn't know how to deal with this new situation. Although we also know that there are composers that were in touch with French publishers and sent their compositions to them. But we don't know, we have not too much sources to know how the French publishers acquired the music from Vienna, except in the case of Vivaldi. You know, we have these letters by Haydn from the 1780s, and we have some offer of Mozart, for example, to Sieber also in the 1780s. He offered him some piano concertos, tuba concertos, which Sieber didn't print, but then Ataria printed. But we also have reports from other musicians that came to France and found their music in print and were very astonished and very honored also. You couldn't expect money for your music being printed. Just when you sell your music to the publisher, you can expect money for once. But most of the time, they just print it. How was this music transformed? Almost in the same way that it was transformed in the monasteries. They changed the instrumentation. So they left out the flutes or the horns, perhaps, or wrote in the Prince horn ad libitum. They changed the series of movements and left out the menuetto, for example. The menuetto is a very difficult case. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not there. And they sometimes changed the text of the music as well. And what they regularly changed was the title of the music. So there is no divertimento in the Paris print market.
Tibetimeno was a very special term in the Austrian context. We have it in the monasteries, and we have it.
This is the term composed by Haydn wrote on their scores. The change from the term divertimento to quattro, or the accato, this was due probably to the printing market, because the traditional name for a spring quartet was divertimento, and Haydn used this term, I think, until 1783 or so in his own scores, and then also changed to quartetto, or quattro, which was internationally the usual term for that. The fourth topic of the project focuses on opera comique in Vienna from 1765 to 1780. We have a very good study on opera comique in the Durazzo era by Bruce L. Brown. So we know a lot of this, of the reception of the genre. Gluck also wrote pieces in this genre. But in the time after that, we don't know too much about it. And this was the time where the opera comique was transformed into German operas, into Singspiel. And it's quite interesting. It's not a linear development from the French to the German, but in the 70s there were many different forms of opera comique at the same time, in the same city, probably at the same theater. So you had the chance to hear an opera comique in French, and you also could hear that opera in a translation with French music. Or there are also pieces that took the libretto, translated it, and wrote new music on that. So a lot of Singspiele is based on a French story. The agents of transfer in this case were mostly groups of French actors and singers who came to Vienna and who played the whole repertoire, and for a couple of months, even sometimes for a year or so, and then left Vienna, and the next group came in. And there were also groups for German that specialized on German pieces. Very interesting is also that they did translate the pieces in Vienna, but mostly used translations that were already present in the German market, that were translated in Frankfurt, for example. There was a big collection of German translations of French pieces, and the Viennese theater people just took this and wrote new music on it, or just took it and took the original music. Guettri was a very important name in this field. Guettri Semire also was a sensational piece that was played very often, and it was also arranged for string quartet, for example. It was arranged for piano, or it was arranged for piano and singer. So you had a lot of possibilities to run across this kind of music in the original way, but also in some arrangements, in many arrangements as well. This part of the project is done by another PhD student, Julia Ackermann. So we have three PhD students that will finish their dissertation hopefully this year. And I had one postdoc, Marco Motnik, did the oratorio topic, and he already found a good job
at the archive of the Gesellschaft der Musikfreunde. And he wrote a very extended article on this topic. But there was one field in there is one field in the project that was done by all four cooperators. And this was a data bank on papers and copyists in Viennese opera scores. In the time span from 1770, this is the time span we are now, 1770 to 1774. This is a bibliographical part of the project. This is basic research, and it's not enough to have just 4 years. The plan is to extend this part of the project for a long period in order to have papers and copies, say, from 1760 or even earlier to 1780. So for the 1780s, we have a lot of material in Mozart and Haydn research, of course. So the idea was not to focus on a composer, not to focus on a location or an archive, but to focus on a source that is datable, and this and that is in a very dense series. So we now have let me see. We did 29 scores at the moment. This is not too much for 3 years, but it takes a while to get through it. We describe it carefully. And we have a data bank of all the copies we found there and all the watermarks, in fact, the papers. And this data bank is also publicly available. It's online, and we are developing it. It's part of a bigger project, the memory of paper. This is a big data bank for watermarks, which is hosted at the Academy of Sciences in Vienna. And we are a smaller part of this kind. The idea is, if we have this very close time span and this very dense series of sources, we have kind of all the papers that were used by professional copyists, and we have all of the hands of professional copyists, and they're amazingly many. We have 67 copies so far in almost 30 scores only, and we have 43 papers so far. And of course, we have to go on with studying how the copyists worked, how the scores were, how the cooperation was done in the scores. There are different scores. Some scores have only one scribe or two scribes, and they had a lot of time to write it, and it was written very slowly. Other scores have perhaps seven different copies, and the finale was written by another one, and there was an aria inserted. So they did it quite hastily, and they have a lot of different papers as well. For the stuff, this is fun to do it, and it's also good for the project to have something in common, because everybody does his own dissertation or own dissertation, his own work, and of course there are connections, but everybody has to do his own work, of course, and this part brings us together from time to time. To do it, and of course it's not only going through the scores to find new material, but also controlling it. This is very hard work. Everybody who ever did it knows. And we also have to compare our scribes to the scribes in the research, especially in the Haydn research. So we identify the scribes by call number or by number, but we don't have names to the scribes. And it's not even the aim to get all the names. We never will do that. But it's important to have them identified. And I'm sure we can identify many of our writers to many writers that are known to the Haydn research, because of it's a lot of Viennese material there. All right, this is my presentation at this point. I'm very happy to receive questions from you, to receive comments, and of course I'm happy to give you more information about the topics as well.